Tom Hall. This is the Midday Health Watch. As Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz is laid to rest this afternoon, we'll begin today with a conversation about heart disease. Mr. Kamenetz's sudden passing has left a lot of people wondering, how can a man who was only 60 years old, not overweight, a healthy eater, and a person who exercised regularly die of a heart attack? Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City, reminds us of what we can do to prevent heart disease. We'll have an update on the status of a lawsuit against the Trump administration about its proposal to cripple efforts to reduce teen pregnancy, plus the dangers of synthetic marijuana. And Jack Everly conducts the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra and the music of John Williams this weekend. We'll have a preview. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Before we begin our show today, an update on the funeral for Kevin Kamenetz, the Baltimore County executive and gubernatorial candidate who died suddenly yesterday morning. His funeral will take place this afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Baltimore Hebrew Congregation in Pikesville. Burial will follow that service, and in accordance with Jewish tradition, his family will sit Shiva in their home Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. The Baltimore Sun reports that in lieu of flowers, the family is asking for donations to the American Cancer Society and the Baltimore Humane Society. We had announced earlier this week that I'd be speaking today with Rushern Baker, the Prince George's County executive, as part of our series of conversations with the candidates. He is, of course, also running for governor in the Democratic primary. Out of respect for Mr. Kamenetz and his family, the Baker campaign and many other candidates have suspended activity until after the funeral. Yesterday, we agreed that Mr. Baker will appear with me here on our program a week from today, next Friday. Later in today's program, I'll talk to Jack Everly, the principal pops conductor of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. He's conducting music of John Williams with the BSO this weekend, and he'll tell us about those concerts. Dr. Lena Wen is here for the Midday Health Watch. But before we speak with Dr. Wen, I want to check in quickly with WIPR's Mary Rose Madden about the news that Baltimore Police Commissioner Daryl D'Souza has been charged by federal prosecutors with not filing tax returns for the years 2013, 2014, and 2015. Mr. D'Souza has admitted to the facts filed in federal court yesterday, and he has apologized. So, Mary Rose, the reaction, for example, of Mayor Catherine Pugh.
Mayor Catherine Pugh said that she supports her police commissioner and it was a mistake, and she hopes that he'll clear it up as soon as possible. I think that there's sort of like a tense moment right now, what folks think he should and shouldn't do. He's apologized and said, you know, he overlooked these 3 years. Folks came down to the Baltimore Police Department's headquarters this morning to try to, you know, show support for him. His twin brother said, you know, he didn't do anything immoral or, you know, intentionally, you know, just overlooked, had just really made a mistake. He was taking care of his ill parents during those years and forgot to file. State lawmakers are saying, you know, are a little stronger on him. You know, they're saying, you know, I think State Senator Bill Ferguson said that he knew he had not paid taxes for these 3 years and took the job of the city's top cop knowing that. And that's a problem. So I think there's like a lot of people either stand on one side or the other, that he should, you know, maybe be suspended. I think the FOP says that he should be suspended while they're clearing this up. And but right now he remains in the position.
I think he's going to have a hard time convincing people that he overlooked paying income taxes for federal and state returns. I mean, this is not the first time he's heard about this. I mean, as I understand how this works, the Internal Revenue Service would send you a letter saying, hey, we haven't received your tax return, and if we don't get it by X date, you will be fined so-and-so. So this is not the first time he's heard about it, and it's very likely, it seems absolutely probable, that he knew that he hadn't filed these returns at the time he was interviewing for the job. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying he overlooked it is one thing. I think when you don't pay your tax returns, you're deciding not to pay your tax returns.
Yeah, I mean, in 2013 is a ways in the past. So it does seem like if you made that kind of mistake, you've had some time to clear it up.
I mean, people who do this, who don't pay their taxes, who don't file returns. I mean, and Mr. D'Souza did make the point that he was working for the Baltimore Police Department throughout this whole period. He had had money, like we all do, deducted for taxes from his paycheck, but he didn't file a return to, you know, complete the process. For all we know, he may have gotten a refund from his deductions from his paycheck.
Right. We don't know that yet, but yeah.
He faces a possible prison term, and certainly he faces fines, one would imagine, but these are serious offenses.
Yeah, $75,000 in fines and 1 year in prison.
All right, and you will, of course, continue to cover it for us, and we appreciate it, and we'll stay in touch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Rose Madden from the WIPR News Department. Now it's my pleasure to welcome back Dr. Lena Wen for our regular feature, the Midday Health Watch. Dr. Wen is the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. Kevin Kamenetz appeared to be in good health, but he died from cardiac arrest. Heart disease is the cause of 1 in 4 early deaths nationwide, and we'll talk about what we can do, perhaps, to reduce our risk. Also, cuts by the Trump administration to the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Initiative led to a lawsuit to reinstate that program. We'll get an update on that. And synthetic marijuana. It's a growing health problem. We'll also talk about what's known as levels of care when it comes to getting help for opioid abuse problems. We are streaming our conversation with Dr. Wen here on the WIPR Facebook page. And if you have a question, you're welcome to pose it. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. Dr. Wen, good to see you.
Nice to see you too. Thanks for having me back.
And by the way, happy Mother's Day. This will be your first Mother's Day as a mom.
That's right. I'm looking forward to celebrating with little Eli.
Well, I hope Eli has a big party planned, you know. So let's talk about, first of all, Mr. Kamenetz. Did you know Kevin Kamenetz?
I did, and my heart just breaks for his family. I mean, I can't imagine what they're going through. I think about if this were my husband, and I didn't know the county executive well, but he was someone that I could always call on to support legislation and services that are related to improving healthcare access for the most vulnerable. He joined with me to talk about protecting the Affordable Care Act, protecting reproductive health rights, to prevent prescription price gouging. I mean, he was a staunch supporter of many of the health initiatives that we worked on. He also very much supported Asian American Pacific Islanders. And so I also worked with him in celebration of AAPIs.
He was also in shape, you know. I mean, I just saw him a couple of weeks ago. He was here. He was an exercise fanatic. He ate well. He was not overweight. He was only 60 years old. When patients like this have these diseases catch up with them the way that Mr. Kamenetz has, how do you explain that? And people talk, by the way, about a heart attack and cardiac arrest. And sometimes people use those terms interchangeably. Is that correct? Is there a distinction between these two things?
They're very different. So let me talk about the heart attack versus cardiac arrest first. So a heart attack is when there are blockages in the arteries in the heart. And so the heart muscle then is not functioning. And people can have a variety of symptoms that are indicative of a heart attack. Cardiac arrest is when the heart stops. That's the definition of cardiac arrest. So it is one possible symptom of a heart attack. Sometimes when a heart attack is so severe, the heart is not functioning, and therefore the person therefore there is cardiac arrest and cessation of the cardiac activity. But heart attacks can also present with other symptoms too. The classic crushing chest pain, the elephant sitting on the chest, the pressure on the chest, also jaw pain, arm pain, shortness of breath. Some patients have lightheadedness, nausea, vomiting. Some patients actually have no symptoms at all. Studies have shown that women and minorities tend to have atypical symptoms and also are less likely to be accurately diagnosed with having a heart attack. I've had patients come in with symptoms that sound like GI illness. They have some nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. They're diagnosed with a viral illness, and then they go home and die because actually they had a heart attack. And so I think it's important for all of us to know the symptoms, to know our own body too. If something just doesn't feel right, this is the time to call for help. Don't hesitate. Don't wait before it's too late. I mean, if you know that you're not feeling yourself or there's a loved one and they are complaining of something that just doesn't sound like them, don't hesitate to ask for assistance.
One in four Americans, some 630,000 of us, die of heart disease every year. It's still very much a leading killer. What are the things that we can do? Some of these things are, you know, have been well trod when we've talked about, you know, just generally speaking, your general health. But heart specific things that one can do to stay out of that statistic.
So here are the risk factors for heart disease, which is also the number one killer here in Baltimore City. The key risk factors for heart disease are high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and smoking. There are other contributors too, like diabetes, physical inactivity, and family history. So if I could give three tips, here's what I would recommend for everyone to do. The first is, if you're smoking, stop smoking. Smoking is the number one preventable contributor to heart disease. Smoking also leads to other illnesses like cancer. We in the health department have resources to help smoking cessation. And it's important to note that just 1 year after stopping smoking, you reduce your risk for heart disease by half. So it really is something that we would encourage everyone to do. Stop smoking first. Second is know your numbers and know your body. Make sure that you go for regular checkups. Just because you feel healthy doesn't mean that you are healthy. Make sure that you go for your regular checkups and be in touch with your body and call for help if anything seems to be the matter. The third thing is watch what it is that we're putting into our body. One in four of our children drink regular soda every day, but only one in five eat their recommended fruits and vegetables, and that's for our kids. Adults also, we have to be conscious of what we're putting into our bodies too. That said, we have to recognize that choice is predicated on privilege. I feel like I'm being a disingenuous physician if I tell my patient to eat better and they say they live in a food desert where they have to drive or they have to take two buses and then walk 10 blocks in order to have healthy foods. And these are things that we should make the choice if we can, but there are things that we as a community have to focus on as well, including we've started now in the city 14 virtual supermarkets and 25 healthy corner stores to improve these healthy food options.
And the virtual supermarkets work how?
These are senior centers, libraries, and other sites where we partner with grocers like ShopRite to deliver food directly to that area. And so seniors in a senior building, for example, can place an order virtually, and then they get they get the food that's delivered to them on a regular basis.
Physical activity also is a really important thing. I mean, you got to give your heart a workout. You got to keep it going. If you're, if you are the person who spends more time on the couch than walking around the neighborhood, that can really catch up with you pretty quickly too.
Absolutely, and physical inactivity then also leads to the other issues that are risk factors for heart disease. They are risk factors for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, and so. Heart disease is complex. There are many different possible causes, and there are individuals who will die from cardiac arrest, right? Their hearts will stop for other reasons that may not be related to cardiovascular to blockage of arteries from poor diet or what we traditionally think of as heart disease. But we need to look at the major risk factors and to talk about the things that all of us are able to do. So stop smoking, know your body, and watch what we're putting into our bodies, starting with our children.
We have an email from Lane who says, and this is an absolutely good point. I mentioned that Mr. Kamenetz was only 60 years old, and he said, how about Len Bias, the famous basketball player for the University of Maryland? He died at age 22. So age really, heart disease knows no bounds when it comes to age.
I don't know the specific case of the basketball player, but when it's someone that young who has died from a heart issue, it's not cholesterol and plaques that's building up in arteries. There is another cause for it, and there are many such causes. But again, important for all of us to know our own bodies, get checked out on a regular basis, and do what we can ourselves while recognizing that there is a societal and economic policy issue to take into account, too, that it's hard to eat healthy if you're poor. It's hard to prioritize exercise if you're homeless, that there are things that we as a society can do so that we see it not only as a health issue, but a societal responsibility, too.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to have more with Dr. Nguyen when we come back from a quick break. We are streaming our conversation on the Facebook page at WIPR. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org. You can find us on Twitter at @MiddayWIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. And you can give us a call, 410-662-8780. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Coming up Monday on our program, it's widely agreed that our politics are broken. My guests on Monday, two former lawmakers who are trying to fix politics, former Maryland Congresswoman Connie Morella and former Indiana Congressman and Ambassador to India, Tim Romer, join me. She's a Republican, he's a Democrat, and they lead Issue One. That's a bipartisan group of nearly 200 former governors, cabinet secretaries, and members of Congress from both parties and all 50 states. So we will hear what they suggest are the remedies to our current political maladies. Plus, this is another weekend of events sponsored and produced by Baltimore Ceasefire. On Monday, we'll talk to one of the founders of the ceasefire movement, Erica Bridgeford. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday Health Watch. Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen joins me here in Studio A. We're taking your calls, your comments, and emails, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and to find us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. You can also hop over to the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming as we speak. Dr. Nguyen, there's one more question about heart disease, so we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to talk about a couple of other things. Dave in Cockeysville, welcome to the program with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Hi, how are you doing, Tom? How are you doing, Lena? My question has, could you comment on the psychosomatic impacts of stress from the unconscious and all the problems Kevin couldn't talk about under his watch as county executive? And what I mean is you can have a healthy person, but there's so much stress being put on them that they can't talk about that it creates a psychosomatic reaction and a tension in the heart that can cause it to fail.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. So the role of stress in heart disease.
Stress is a risk factor. I think that the caller is right, that there are many elements of mental health and psychosocial health that we typically don't think together with physical health, but we know that they have effects on each other. And the converse is true too, right? That individuals who have heart disease and other illnesses also may have additional issues associated with mental health and social isolation and other factors too. So all of these are issues that deserve further study and attention to.
All right, one more call about the issues of heart disease from another caller from Baltimore County. Janet, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, thank you. I have a question. Is there always shortness of breath in a heart attack?
There is not always shortness of breath with a heart attack. Heart attacks can manifest with many different types of symptoms. Shortness of breath could be one of them. But again, some people have heart attacks who may have no symptoms at all, or may have just a very vague stomach, abdominal discomfort. And that's, again, why it's so important to know our bodies, know our numbers, and call for help. Don't hesitate. There was a recent study that found that women will wait an hour longer before going to the ER for a heart attack than men. And we know from other studies that women, African Americans, other minorities tend to be misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed when they go to the hospital too. So be your own best advocate and know yourself.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing about heart disease. I mean, the symptoms vary from person to person. And sometimes patients would present to you in an ER and you wouldn't know they're having a heart attack until you do blood work, right? It's not something you could see them see physically or observe. I mean, you just have to take a blood sample and then that'll show you that they're having a heart attack. It's tricky.
A blood sample or EKG. But again, everyone is different. And so just don't be afraid to ask for help when it's your life that's on the line.
So let's talk a little bit about something that's called levels of care. There was a town hall sponsored by our colleagues over at WJZ a couple days ago. This is related to the opioid epidemic, and this is, of course, something that you've been very much out front on, a national leader, about engaging and solving the opioid crisis. What do folks mean when they talk about levels of care?
Addiction is a disease. We've talked about this many times on your show, and I'm glad that we're getting out the message that addiction is a disease that needs to be seen as no differently than any other illness. But can you imagine a patient showing up to a hospital and the hospital saying, oh, we don't treat patients with diabetes here, or we don't treat patients with cancer here? That would never happen, but that happens for the disease of addiction all the time. So what Mayor Pugh and I have done is that we convened the hospital leadership from all 11 of our hospitals. And we announced together with our hospital partners that we're establishing a voluntary level of care certification for our hospitals. They'll be designated as level 1, level 2, level 3, similar to what we do for trauma centers, with level 1 being the highest level. And we will be stratifying our hospitals based on the level of service that they're providing for addiction and substance use services. I will say that our hospitals in Baltimore are phenomenal hospitals. They are known nationwide, internationally, for their superb care, including now of addiction care and substance use services, too. Nearly all 11 of our emergency departments offer buprenorphine, medication-assisted treatment, on demand from the EDs. Nearly all of our EDs have a peer recovery specialist, someone who is in recovery themselves to assist others who are presenting with addiction. This is true, as far as I know, of no other city in America. Our hospitals are already leading the way, but we know that we can all do more, especially at a time of an emergency where more than 700 people in our city died from overdose last year. We can all step up more. And so I want to commend Mayor Pugh for her leadership in challenging our hospitals to do more and to really change the norms around the country, to say a level of care of zero is just inappropriate, because we would never do that for any other illness. So let's treat addiction just as we would any other disease. And I commend our hospitals, too, for stepping up. So we have published the levels and the concept behind the levels of care on our website, health.baltimorecity.gov. We're open for public comment until the end of the month. And so we invite all of our listeners, community members, partners, providers, to weigh in and let us know what they think about this proposal.
So, for example, could it be that certain hospitals will have to make big capital investments, big monetary commitments to have the kinds of programs, the kinds of resources available in these emergency departments that they're going to need? I mean, is this going to be something that will have a financial impact on these organizations?
Well, let me describe these levels as evidence-based, science-based best practices. These are things like screening every patient who's coming in for whether they have an addiction and substance use issue, offering treatment on demand for those who screen positive, helping patients at risk for overdose to get naloxone, and making sure that doctors are prescribing opioids in a judicious and careful manner. Many of these things are related to policies. They don't require investment of resources. Sometimes they could be perceived as needing specific resources, but we also have technical assistance that hospitals are providing each other and that we are providing to our hospitals too. And if there are resources that are required, we will assist hospitals and apply for grants together, apply for or advocate to our state and federal partners together. So it's not so much about resources, but about the willpower, the mentality, and the commitment to addressing addiction and to all, I want Baltimore to be known and all of our hospitals to be known, not only as the Center for Excellence for Cancer and Cardiovascular Work, but also for addiction and substance use treatment, too.
I wonder if it's at all analogous in your mind, analogous to mental health care, because, you know, people come in with mental health issues to emergency departments all the time. And we've had some, you know, very scary situations happen where certain hospitals have found it very difficult to handle those situations. More and more people are addicted to opioids. So obviously the problem is growing. It's not shrinking. This is going to become a bigger problem for hospitals, because all signs are that this problem is going to get worse before it gets better. It's difficult. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on emergency departments. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it?
Absolutely. I practice in emergency departments. I'm an emergency physician, and all of the frontline providers that I know, every nurse, every social worker, every physician, we want to do the right thing. But we need the resources to be able to do it. We don't want to turn away a patient who's coming in seeking help for addiction or mental health. But if we don't have any resources at the hospital that are part of that health system, what are we supposed to do? Then we also get burned out. Then we also get cynical and we blame the system. But what we're saying here, what Mayor Pugh and I are saying here, is that, look, we are the system. We, together with our healthcare organizations and our hospitals, we are the system and we can do something about it. I also want to highlight something that can be done on a legislative level as well. Speaking of resources, a couple weeks ago, Congressman Elijah Cummings and Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced the CARE Act, which is the Ryan White for the opioid epidemic. Nearly 30 years ago was the peak of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and members of Congress, in a bipartisan fashion, got together and said, this is a treatable, preventable disease. We can do something about it if we had the resources there, and we do. I mean, it would be unconscionable for us to say we don't have the resources and for us to look our children and our grandchildren in the eye and say we let this go out of control. And so the CARE Act is to have a large amount of funding that's proportional to the severity of the illness in a sustained manner. So it's not just one-off at a time, 1 year at a time, but sustained so that we can build the proper infrastructure and direct. It's directly given to local jurisdictions like Baltimore City so that we can do things like put in the treatment resources in our hospitals. And I hope that that passes.
And the kind of resources they're talking about are measured in the billions. I mean, this is a lot of money.
It absolutely
But what they're
is.
Saying basically is that they've got to attack this problem the way we attacked the HIV/AIDS problem in the 1980s.
That's right. It is a lot of money, but as Congressman Cummings frequently reminds us, we cannot just talk about the cost of an intervention. We have to talk about the cost of doing nothing. And the cost of doing nothing is that in the time that you and I are sitting here having this interesting conversation, 5 people around the country will die from overdose.
The president, Donald Trump, is scheduled to give a press conference in the Rose Garden today, a speech about prices in the pharmaceutical industry. So we'll see what happens with that. But when it comes to resources, naloxone, which is the product that can be used to literally save a person's life who is in an overdose situation, in a crisis, an acute situation, the cost of naloxone is skyrocketing. And it makes it very difficult for Baltimore City Health Department to dispense it and get it to folks who are in this kind of acute crisis. Where do things stand with that, both on the local level and the national level?
locally, we are rationing naloxone every day. Every day, my staff and I count how many units of naloxone we have left and have to decide who to give it to and who has to go without. We did an analysis, just a back-of-the-envelope calculation of this, and I want to give you a couple of numbers. Every unit of naloxone, every kit of naloxone that we buy costs us $75. Depending on who you are, it may seem like a lot of money or not a lot of money, but if we were to get naloxone to every one of our residents in the city, that's $47 million. That's more than the city spends on the entire health department budget. We obviously can't afford that, so as a result, we have to ration. I understand from our outreach workers who are on the front lines that heroin costs $6. How does it make sense that naloxone costs 10 times the cost of heroin? I mean, we can't possibly ask for everyone to purchase naloxone in order to save people's lives. And what we've been asking the federal government to do is to either give us the money to purchase more naloxone or to directly negotiate with the manufacturers of naloxone and to use the specific powers that the federal government has to declare an emergency and to make naloxone affordable at a rate that is appropriate in the middle of an epidemic. In India, one could get naloxone for 15 cents. Why are we paying millions and millions of dollars to access a life-saving medication? In our city, everyday residents have used Narcan or naloxone to save nearly 2,000 lives in 2 years. But imagine how many more we can save if only we had the ability to do so.
There's apparently just a few manufacturers, four or five, that produce naloxone. And the answer to your question, you know, certainly to a certain extent, is price gouging on the parts of these companies. I mean, they are taking advantage. There's one statistic I have sitting in front of me. These are a chart of recent and current prices for naloxone. There's an auto injector, which is a two-pack of single-use pre-filled auto injectors, thing called Evzio, or Evzio. In 2015, they sold for $690. And in 2016, the price went up to $4,500 for a two-pack of naloxone. That I just can't imagine that their research and development costs were that high.
These companies will say that they give away and they donate their products to local jurisdictions like ours. And we, in fact, in Baltimore, have been the beneficiary of these companies that are donating. And we would not turn away any donations because this is a matter of life saved. For every 11 units of naloxone that I hand out on our needle exchange fans, that my team hands out our needle exchange fans, out of 11, one is used to save someone's life. This is the power of what we can do. I don't know that I would fault the companies for what they're doing because they're satisfying their shareholders. But I do fault the federal government for not intervening. If it is true that we are a state of public health emergency, as President Trump has declared, then what are we doing about it? This is within the federal government's ability and jurisdiction. They've done this before. Why can't we do it now in order to save lives?
The president did declare the opioid epidemic as a public health emergency back in October, and you and others are calling on the administration to use a law that the Bush administration used back during the 2001 anthrax scare, when all of a sudden it looked like maybe anthrax the antidote to anthrax would be scarce. So there is precedent for this as well.
That's right. There's precedent. It just doesn't make sense that we have a life-saving medication available by the pennies in other countries that we're rationing here. The Surgeon General recently issued an advisory for naloxone, which is great. I'm glad that he is saying that and calling on every resident to carry this life-saving medication, which is something that we've been doing in Baltimore for the last 2.5 years. But the problem for us is not the policy, it's the price. We can have all the advisories in the world, but if we simply don't have the money to purchase it, then what good does that do?
Let's talk a little bit about synthetic marijuana. We talked a lot in the during the session this year, the legislative session in Annapolis, about licenses to grow marijuana. But there's an increasing problem of synthetic marijuana. And sometimes people who are taking these substances are dying from them.
I want to be clear that synthetic marijuana is not marijuana at all. Some of these substances may work in a similar way to marijuana, hence their name, because they bind to similar receptors in the brain. But these are chemicals that are manufactured in labs. Then these chemicals are sprayed onto dried plants and often sold as potpourri. The people who use synthetic marijuana should know that it's like playing Russian roulette. You have no idea what chemical is in there. You don't know what you're going to get, and you could die. In other parts of the country, including in Illinois, there have been reports of individuals with life-threatening bleeding after using synthetic marijuana, which is also known as spice or K2. And now there are 18 people in Maryland who have been hospitalized for this bleeding, including 10 here in Baltimore City. And so we need everyone's help to spread the message. Please do not use synthetic marijuana. You could get severe bleeding from your gums, coughing up blood, throwing up blood in your urine or stools, or even death. Also, if you have used these substances in the last 3 months and you have any signs of bleeding, go to the ER. It is illegal in Baltimore City to sell synthetic marijuana. We had legislation passed a couple of years ago to declare that it's illegal. And so if you see it in any of our corner stores or any stores that are selling synthetic marijuana, K2, Spice, please call 311 and report that store.
We have just about 30 seconds left, Dr. Nguyen. Baltimore City is part of a lawsuit against the Trump administration having to do with teen pregnancy prevention initiative. And so far, the rulings in the courts have been in the favor of the city. So right now, the initiatives that you've had about teen pregnancy are able to be sustained. Is that right?
So far, we heard a few weeks ago that the ruling was in favor of Baltimore City, which means that HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, violated the law in their decision to cut our grant. So they have to remake their decision consistent with federal law. They may still appeal. From our standpoint, we will continue to fight because this is about 20,000 of our students who will no longer have access to critical reproductive health education.
And teen pregnancy has, we've witnessed a big decrease in teen pregnancy since these programs were put in effect.
61% reduction in teen birth rates since 2000. We cannot afford to roll back the gains that we've made, especially when the programs that we have are evidence-based, science-based. We received no justification for these cuts. And for us, this is about protecting our youth and being on the side of science and evidence.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, always good to see you. We'll see you the next time. And again, happy Mother's Day.
Nice to join you. Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner of Baltimore City. A reminder that this weekend is another Baltimore Ceasefire Weekend. There are many, many events planned, some of which are underway already. We've got a link to the complete calendar at WIPR.org/midday. And on Monday, Erica Bridgeford, one of the Baltimore Ceasefire founders, will join me here in Studio A. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break, BSO Pops conductor Jack Everly tells us about bringing Indiana Jones to the Meyerhof this weekend. And Joel McCord from our newsroom has told me that Mayor Pugh is scheduled to give an announcement or have a press conference about Commissioner D'Souza at 1 o'clock. We will keep you informed. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.